all the hypersonic missiles fired by Iran have hit their targets after evading Israel's air defense systems. Iran warns that Tehran will give a harsh response to enemies who might try to cross the country's red lines and harm its national interests. Also in the headlines, another Palestinian youth has been killed as Israeli forces launch a fresh, deadly incursion into the city of Nablus in the occupied West Bank. Well, welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. Thanks for joining us. Iran has retaliated against Israel over the regime's deadly attack on the Iranian embassy in Syria early this month. Iran says the attack targeted an Israeli airbase and an intelligence headquarters near Syria that were behind the deadly attack on the Iranian embassy. Hundreds of drones, ballistic and cruise missiles were used in the attack. It was conducted in several stages from multiple directions in order to suppress and overwhelm Israel's missile shields. Tehran says the attack has achieved all of its objectives. This was the first time that Iran directly attacked the Israeli-occupied territories. All hypersonic missiles fired by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps have hit their designated targets in Israel, marking the first time Iran employs such weapons against real targets. Sources have informed Press TV that the Israeli regime and its supporters failed to intercept any of the hypersonic missiles fired by Iran. These missiles were fired alongside drones, other ballistic and cruise missiles during the retaliatory operation against Israel. Iran is one of the few countries that possesses the technology to produce hypersonic missiles. These missiles can travel at stunning speeds and hit their targets with great precision. Iran's hypersonic missiles are highly maneuverable, enabling them to have an unpredictable flight path in order to confuse the enemy's missile shields. The IRGC says tracking Iran's hypersonic missiles is impossible. Sonal Salasad is a journalist and commentator who joins us. Welcome. When you take a look at the capabilities that Iran has, the hypersonic missiles was unveiled towards the end of last year, and it was used now in this retaliatory action by Iran, which is in a combat mode. And it's just one of the many arsenals or options that Iran has, which it decided to use. What does that say about Iran's military capabilities?
The missiles that Iran has used, this reflects the advanced capabilities and military capabilities of Iran. And this despite the brutal sanction that Iran has been since the establishment of the Islamic Revolution. These brutal sanctions, you know, they have been imposed on Iran just because Iran has refused to accept the Western hegemony. And I've seen throughout the years that Iran hasn't used its weapons or its military capabilities in order to terrorize other nations, just as the American administration and the Zionist colonial regime do, but in order to empower the oppressed nations across the globe, especially here in the Palestinian resistance. As without the assistance of Iran, the Palestinian resistance wouldn't have been able to face this aggression. Iran has relied on its people and its local capabilities in order to empower itself and in order to advance these capabilities for peaceful reason. And despite that, still the West, and specifically the American administration, trying to restrict these capabilities. But Iran, day after day and year after year, is proving that it's capable of elaborating its capabilities and using them, as I've mentioned, for peaceful reasons.
Well, it's one thing for Iran to show the different types of missiles or drones or other military equipment that it has in its arsenal on display, but it's another to actually use it. And now that it has been used, and now that the Israeli regime, for example, has seen what it can do, what type of message do you think that sends Iran's adversaries?
Yes, what happened on the day of the 14th of April is quite different from the previous years. It's a turning point in the Iranian policy. It's the end of the so-called strategies which Iran has long used with this with those enemies. It's a turning point because now the enemies have comprehended that their attacks and their aggression against Iran and against the nation won't go unanswered. And this is actually a righteous right for Iran to stand against this aggression and to use its military capabilities to defend its sovereignty and also, as I have mentioned, to support the righteous resistance actions in the region.
And another thing that Iran has said is that the era of hit and run is over in reference to the Israeli regime. And the posture now of Iran has been that if its assets, personnel, or anything that has to deal with the Islamic Republic is targeted, particularly by the Israeli regime, that Iran will retaliate from Iran itself. That's a new, not only a new announcement, but a new posture there by Iran. What are your thoughts on that?
Yes, because, you know, as in the previous year, all the time, the enemies, especially also their puppet regimes here in West Asia, the Persian Gulf regimes, all the time accused Iran of using the other nations' territories in order to launch its operation. But this time, as we have said, that this operation has been quite significant because Iran has said that Iran has proved and stressed that it can defend itself wherever it is, and especially from the Iranian nation. And this in itself is a message for those regimes who have let the Palestinian without any help. We have seen that Iran, which is far away from Palestine, has shown that it's capable of attacking this regime, which Imam Khomeini has once said that if every Muslim throw a bottle of water on this regime, it would have collapsed a long time ago. But unfortunately, we have seen other regimes who have normalized ties with the Zionists, and it's a quiet message for them also that this colonial regime has failed to protect itself. So the normalization ties have failed and will not keep your regimes. It's only turning to the interest of your nation and protecting the interest of the Islamic nation.
Thank you very much. Anyway, Sundal Assad there, journalist and commentator from Beirut. Thank you. Moving on, the UN Security Council has held an emergency meeting at the request of the Tel Aviv regime following Iran's drone and missile attacks on Israeli targets in the occupied territories. In an opening speech, the UN chief reiterated his condemnation of the Israeli attack on the premises of the Iranian embassy in Damascus.
The principle of inviolability of diplomatic and consular premises and personnel must be respected in all cases, in accordance with international law, as I stated when condemning the 1 April attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus. Madam President, it's time to step back from the brink. It's vital to avoid any action that could lead to major military confrontations on multiple fronts in the Middle East. Civilians are already bearing the brunt and paying the highest price.
Guterres further called for de-escalation in the region. He then reminded UN member states of their collective responsibility to work toward the establishment of an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. The UN chief also highlighted the importance of delivering humanitarian aid to residents of Gaza and securing the release of all captives. He added all UN members are duty-bound to stop Israel's acts of violence in the occupied West Bank and re-establish safe navigation in the Red Sea. He urged efforts to further promote regional and international peace and security. Also speaking at the Security Council's emergency meeting, the Russian envoy to the UN once again condemned the Israeli strike on the consular section of the Iranian embassy in Damascus, urging UN member states to denounce such an act.
When we met in this chamber on the 2nd of April so as to discuss the strike by Israel against the consular premises of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Damascus, we warned that what was needed was a strong and unified signal by the Council that such actions were unacceptable. And not only against the sovereign states of Iran or Syria, and not only in the Middle East, but anywhere in the world. We called upon the colleagues in Security Council to clearly and unequivocally condemn such reckless steps to make sure that they don't get repeated.
The Russian envoy further lashed out at the U.S., Britain, and France for refusing to abide by principles of international law, namely on the immunity of diplomatic facilities. Separately, the Chinese ambassador to the U.N. also condemned the Israeli regime's attack on the Iranian embassy in Syria. He dismissed the incident as a gross violation of the UN Charter and international law. By launching such an attack, he added that Tel Aviv violated the sovereignty of both Syria and Iran. Meanwhile, Iran's ambassador and permanent representative to the UN said Iran's drone and missile strike on Israeli targets in the occupied territories was in retaliation for the Israeli strike on the Iranian embassy.
The armed forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran carried out a series of military strikes on Israeli military objectives with thousands of missiles and drones. Iran's operation was entirely in the exercise of Iran's inherent right to self-defense as outlined in Article 51 of the Charter of the United Nations and recognized by international law. This concluded action was necessary and proportionate. It was precise and only targeted military objectives and carried out carefully to minimize the potential for escalation and prevent civilian harm. Madam President, we thank those members of the Council who condemned the Israeli armed attack against our diplomatic premises in Syria. As a responsible member of the United Nations, the Islamic Republic of Iran is committed to the purpose and principles enshrined in the Charter of the United Nations, reaffirms once more its commitment to the maintenance of international peace and security. The Islamic Republic of Iran reiterates its consistent position that it does not seek escalation or war in the region, while warning about any further military provocation by the Israeli regime. The Islamic Republic of Iran reaffirms its unwavering determination to defend its people, national security and interest, sovereignty and territorial integrity against any threat or act of aggression, and to respond to any such threat or aggression vigorously and in accordance with international law. The Islamic Republic of Iran will not hesitate to exercise this right when required.
Tehran says stage by stage, Iran will give stronger responses in order to deter and to punish any aggressor who might cross its red lines.
Now, Iran does not seek escalation of tension in the region. Iran stresses again that it is committed to the goals and aspirations as per the United Nations Charter and international law regarding passing the red lines of Iran. In any stage, Iran will stand stronger than the previous stage in order to create deterrence and to punish the aggressor, the violator, or any illogical and illegal move, Iran will take action. So I should highlight again that Iran's action was necessary and proportionate, and it hit military targets.
Khalani said Iran's action was completely legitimate and in accordance with the UN Charter. He said the operation was carried out after diplomatic ultimatums were ignored by Israel's allies. He added that Western countries should appreciate Iran for its responsible behavior and restraint towards Israel. The spokesman also said inaction of the U.S. Security Council and the irresponsible behavior by the U.S., U.K., and France forced Iran to take action in order to defend its security and national interests. Iran's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, in a phone call with his Russian counterpart, says the Operation True Promise meant to warn Israel that any future aggression will be answered. Amir Abdollahian confirmed that the Operation True Promise was executed to punish the Zionist regime for its recent crimes. Amir Abdollahian further signified the importance of Russia's role in de-escalating tensions in the region. Russia's foreign minister, for his part, criticized some members of the UN Security Council for not condemning Israel's strike on Iran's embassy in Syria. Sergei Lavrov also mentioned that Russia strongly supports Iran in exercising its inherent right to defend itself. With that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
Liberal democracies remain shamefully complicit with the Zionist regime despite its ongoing genocide against the Palestinian people. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East I wrote, students of world politics have long understood that when it comes to the strategic interest of leading states, international law is marginalized unless it is useful in waging a propaganda war against adversaries. Indeed, the United Nations was designed in ways that recognize this feature of international political life. Otherwise, giving the winners of the Second World War a right of veto would make no sense. Such an exemption from international law was also evident at the war crimes trials held in Nuremberg and Tokyo after the Second World War, at which only the crimes of the looters were scrutinized for legal accountability and obvious crimes of the victors, such as the indiscriminate bombing of Dresden and the atomic bomb attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, were not prosecuted. To this day, For understandable reasons, many in Japan believe the use of weapons of mass destruction against the civilian population of these two cities constituted genocide. Of all the red lines, none was more widely acknowledged than genocide, despite it being often difficult to establish legally in the midst of ethnic conflicts or wartime combat. Genocide is clearly proscribed in international law and by diplomatic pressures, which have mounted as the Zionist regime onslaught has persisted, public outrage has intensified, and the complicity of the West has continued unabated. The pre-Gaza normative authority of the label of genocide was so great that former U.S. President Bill Clinton in 1994 prohibited the use of the word in official discourse, fearing that terming the slaughter in Rwanda a genocide would create irresistible pressures on the U.S. to act to stop the mass killing. Serbia's mid-1990s policies of ethnic cleansing in the Bosnian War were challenged in the International Court of Justice as genocide, but the problems of establishing intent proved too great. Most recently, Myanmar's repression of Rohingya Muslims was widely considered to be genocide, leading to a challenge by Gambia at the ICJ, with the case still pending. For years, the Zionist regime successfully invoked the Holocaust to obscure Israel's own atrocity-laden process of coercive tactics, seeking the maximum dispossession and expulsion of the indigenous majority of Palestinians in the process of establishing the fake regime of Israel in 1948 and occupying East Al-Quds, the West Bank, and Gaza since 1967 war. It deflected the hostile global chorus opposing its occupation policies as expressions of anti-Semitism, and even now meets criticism of its practices with the specious argument that it could not be guilty of genocide as it was itself the victim of the largest genocide of all time, a contention recalling W.H. Auden's famous line in a poem, "Those to whom evil is done to do evil in return." How then can we understand this willingness of former Western colonial powers to keep providing various levels of support to the child killer regime of Israel while it carries out in real time the most transparent genocide in all of human history? This killing process has shockingly been justified by dehumanizing language employed by the Zionist regime top leaders, including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and War Minister Yoav Gallant. For 6 months, the indiscriminate and disproportionate violence has devastated the 2.3 million Palestinian civilians living in Gaza, destroying their already impoverished habitat. Genocide serves as a coercive instrument to induce mass forced expulsion, enacting the settler ethos of leave or die. The Netanyahu coalition government that took office in January 2023 was regarded, even in the West, as the most extremist leadership in all of the Zionist regime's history. What made it extreme, aside from cabinet positions for leaders of Jewish Power Party, Itamar Ben-Gvir, and religious Zionism, Bezalel Smotrich, was the immediate green lighting of settler violence in the occupied West Bank, the erasure of any Palestinian political entity on a map of the new Middle East unfurled by Netanyahu at the UN, and above all, a thinly disguised resolve to complete the Zionist project by incorporating the West Bank and possibly Gaza into Greater Israel. Several months after this government took office came the October 7th Al-Aqsa Storm operation. The Zionist regime onslaught followed, culminating in authoritative international pronouncements suggesting that the Zionist regime was guilty of genocide. The ICJ in January ruled that it was plausible the child-killing regime of Israel had committed acts of genocide in Gaza, with the court voting 15-2 to order the regime to take all possible measures to stop such acts. More conclusively, in March, a meticulous report from the UN Special Rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territories found reasonable grounds to believe that the threshold indicating the Zionist regime's commission of genocide is met. Although Israeli regime's leaders from the outset made no effort to hide their genocidal intentions, and the imagery of nightly TV and social media made this genocide palpable to the eyes and ears of the world, it strangely did not move the world's liberal democracies to adjust their policies. Above all, the US regime held fast. It vetoed a series of ceasefire resolutions at the UN Security Council, called the ICJ genocide case meritless, and dismissed the analytically impressive genocide report of the distinguished UN Special Rapporteur Francisca Albanese as the work of an anti-Semite. It vetoed a series of ceasefire resolutions at the UN Security Council, called the ICJ genocide case meritless, and dismissed the analytically impressive genocide report of the distinguished UN Special Rapporteur Francisca Albanese as the work of an anti-Semite, all while pushing for congressional approval of increased military aid, bombs, and munitions to Israel, alongside continued unflagging diplomatic support in international venues. The U.S. regime finally toned down this unconditional posture only after it became clear that it was hurting President Joe Biden's 2024 re-election prospects, and after the furious backlash that followed the attack this month on a World Central Kitchen convoy, which killed 7 aid workers, 6 of whom were Westerners, tasked with bringing food to starving Palestinians. This caused a media uproar in the West so great that it prompted Netanyahu to make a rare apology. This tragic incident also validated the suspicion that the killing of innocent Europeans has much greater political resonance in the West than the killing of thousands of innocent Palestinians, including hospitalized patients and staff. How do we explain this shameful complicity with the Zionist regime and this total rejection of international law in the face of such a transparent and cruel genocide? If the US regime is prepared to exonerate Israel from genocide, the crime of crimes, in this blatant manner, it sends a message to the world that even under the most horrifying circumstances, geopolitical affinities take precedence over law and morality, even for liberal democracies. There are other factors that have contributed to this dark turn in global policy, including the dehumanization of the Palestinian people for decades by assuming the whole population of Gaza is tainted by Hamas. The Orientalist view that Palestinians and all Arab Muslims are somehow subhuman, crude pressures brought in the US by the Israeli lobby, and a lingering guilty conscience in Europe, especially Germany.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, the skies over the Zionist-occupied territories were lit up by hundreds of Iranian drones and missiles late on Saturday night and early Sunday morning. Settlers ran for cover while natives looked up to the skies with hope, and people in the region celebrated the beginning of Iran's retaliatory strikes against the Israeli entity. Well, stay with us as we look at what it all means, Iran's retaliatory attack on the Zionist regime, and now what's likely to happen on this spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Out of Bethlehem, New York, former U.S. Marine Intelligence Officer Scott Ritter. Out of London, historian and author Shivan Mahendraraja.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with me. Let's start it off in London, actually, with Shivan. And the Israeli regime being an invincible power has been a narrative that the Western hegemonic front, along with the regime, has propagated for decades. And, of course, the resistance front has been destroying the narrative for years now, from Hezbollah to Hamas and now Iran, with its retaliatory strikes inside of the occupy territories. Your thoughts about how this has affected the Zionist regime, actually losing this narrative and understanding that it's definitely not invincible.
Well, thank you very much for having me here. I'm actually honored to also be with Scott Ritter on the show. So I actually think that this is really an eye-opener for Israelis, and I mean just ordinary Israelis as much as it is for the government, because this narrative of invincibility has been built up for many years, but also the younger generation has not experienced war. They have not had to go into air raid shelters, nor have to hear air raid warnings like their parents and grandparents did up through the Yom Kippur War. So this raid of something like 185 drones, some 110 ballistic missiles. They came in from different parts. So all of Israel was lit up with air raid warnings, about 750 air raid warnings, I believe. I could be wrong. But anyway, a lot of people are going into shelters. They were panicking even before this. And now that sense of security is gone, because this is actually a very successful raid. Now, there are people who are saying, oh, well, only about three or four missiles hit, everything else was shot down. Actually, no, because what they did was to overwhelm and to confuse the air defense systems of Israel, plus all the people who were helping Israel, Jordan, U.S., France, Britain, and the U.S., of course. And the targets were hit, what they wanted to strike. Some of the other missiles and drones were shot down, but it was at a huge cost, not just financial cost, but in terms of the interceptors that were used. They cannot keep doing this if they want to escalate with Iran, and Iran keeps launching wave after wave after wave, day after day. At some point, Israel is going to run out of missiles, because these things just can't be manufactured overnight, and there is a limited amount of stock, and the U.S. has to hold on to some of the stock that they have for their own purposes, as well as all the other things that they want to do in terms of, you know, a war with China, or in case NATO needs them. So anyway, I think this is quite successful. And it was what I call a reconnaissance in force, by the way, in the sense is that they use a fair amount of force, but not overwhelming force. And I think the Iranian IRGC airspace learned a lot about Israel's air defenses from what happened yesterday, as to what can get through, what Israel can throw back up at them. So that if this escalates, there is a lot that they can use.
Okay, stay with me, Shivan. Sorry to interrupt. Let me get Scott in on this conversation. Well, Scott, I mean, your assessment of Iran being able to penetrate the Israeli airspace and several layers of its defense mechanisms.
Well, first of all, I want to echo everything that your guest Shivan just said. He's 100% correct. This was an extraordinarily successful attack by Iran on Israel. We need to understand, first of all, the objective of the attack. It was to prove a point that Iran could, in fact, strike Israel at a time and place of its choosing. Iran made a decision, I believe, in this attack to limit the scope and scale of the attack so as to not give Israel a reason to retaliate to the Iranian retaliation. The Iranians wanted to demonstrate a capability, put Israel and its allies, including the United States, on notice that Iran possesses a viable deterrence, and that Iran will strike those who strike Iran, and that the price that will be paid will be heavy, and therefore nations should think twice before attacking Iran. And I think that this objective was achieved. We see that by the United States pressuring Israel not to launch an attack, and Israel not pushing back very hard, because Israeli officers, you know, you talked about this narrative, this concept of Israeli invincibility. Israeli officers, and I've worked with them in the past, are very professional. They're very realistic, and they know what the truth is. They have, for the past 2 years, conducted war games where they exercise a scenario that has Israel being attacked simultaneously by Hezbollah, by Syria, by Iran. And a key aspect of their thinking going in, of the calculations they make, is the effectiveness of their air defense systems. And you have politicians in Israel who give high credence to Israeli air defense, and you have the military that's more balanced, more realistic. They know for certain now that their air defense will not stop an Iranian attack. That if Iran was to launch a full-scale attack, combined with Hezbollah, Syria, and others, that they would overwhelm Israeli air defense and inflict devastating, if not lethal, damage to the Israeli state. And so this is the impact. The Israelis now know for a fact that should they ever attack Iran, the consequences to Israel will be devastating. And this is the element of deterrence that Iran wanted to establish.
Okay. Well, speaking of that element of deterrence, Shivan, do you think in general that with Iran's attack on the Israeli regime, that there is now a different paradigm which has been established, and that the Israelis realize that they will have to answer, Tehran will make them answer, perhaps even inside the occupied territories, for any type of aggression that they may initiate against Iran?
Yes. What has happened before is that since Iran was practicing strategic patience, there were many commentators and probably some, you know, in intelligence services and the military as well, who probably, you know, in Europe, U.S., Israel, who thought Iran was scared, that they were afraid to actually hit Iran, to hit Israel, but they would only use quote-unquote proxies to do the work for them. What happened today shows that Iran is more than willing to strike into Israel. And the announcement that the age of era of strategic patience is over is, I think, a very big announcement, because now what they are saying out of Tehran is basically, you hit us anywhere on our soil or in Syria, we will strike you at home. No more of this quote-unquote proxy business. And that, I think, should be a very, very strong lesson. But I think there's also the other factor which I would like to add in here, which also gets into the deterrence, is that now some of this information is very preliminary as to how many were launched, how many were shot down, what happened. But there is one good estimate out there that says only about 50% of Iran's ballistic missiles were actually shot down. And this should scare not just the Israelis, but the Americans as well, because the systems used by the Israelis for the most part are American. Now think about what's happened, what would happen if Israel does manage to create a regional war, which is what Netanyahu wants, which means the United States gets involved. Now, Israel has a very thick air defense blanket, but some of the American bases, certainly in Syria and in Iraq, but also in some of these other countries like Qatar, don't have that kind of air defense capability. And if Iran can get through to Israel's air defense, Israel's air defenses, they will be able to overwhelm American air defenses in Syria, Iraq, Qatar, UAE, and Kuwait. And that should scare the Americans into thinking, you know, Israel, don't do anything stupid.
Okay. Well, Scott, as you said earlier, Iran initiated a calculated and limited response against the military sites. Now, why do you think that Iran gave a controlled response? And also, I'd like to look at the example that Iran is showing by not attacking civilian areas, but only military targets. I mean, much opposite of what, unfortunately, we have been witnessing the last 6.5 months in the genocide in Gaza.
Well, I think, first of all, we have to point out that Iran did not initiate the sequence of events that led to this, to the need for this action. That Iran is responding to irresponsible and illegal behavior on the part of Israel. Behavior that isn't just limited to the attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, but has extended to Israeli involvement in the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists on Iranian soil, etc. Your other guest, Mr. Shervin, talked about Iran's policy of strategic patience, but it's more than that. Let's look at what Iran's been doing diplomatically in the last year or so. One, normalizing relations with Saudi Arabia. That's a very big step that shows that Iran is not posturing itself for regional confrontation, but rather regional stability. Iran has joined the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Iran has joined BRICS, which means that the Iranian focus is not on military aggression, but economic co-prosperity, economic cooperation. Iran has been struggling under international sanctions for decades now, and they are finally seeing a pathway to where they can look at normal economic relations with a good percentage of the world. Iran's not going to throw this away in an irresponsible military behavior. Iran is not looking for a fight. But Iran also can't stand by and allow Israel to carry out an attack of this nature, because left unpunished, Israel would just be more emboldened to do bigger and bigger acts. So Iran had no choice but to carry out an act of this nature. But this action was designed not to be decisive. I think people need to understand that. This was a deliberate act of constraint on the part of Iran, because they are not looking for a war. They are looking for peace. They are looking for stability, but they had no choice but to reestablish a policy, a posture of deterrence. And they've done that. It was a very calculated action on the part of Iran, both in terms of how they did this. What nation broadcasts the fact that they're going to attack another nation 5 hours in advance? And yet that's what Iran did, by sending out in a very publicized manner its loud Shahid drones. They told Israel, here we come. You have 5 hours to move your critical material away from stuff. Look at what they targeted. They didn't saturate an airbase. They hit one or two runways. They hit some empty warehouses. They let Israel know that Iran can look at a point on a map and hit that point on the map. But they also let Israel know that Iran deliberately avoided the high-value targets, deliberately avoided the places where they could generate high numbers of casualties. Iran was not looking to punish Israel. Iran was simply looking to put Israel on notice that if Israel continues this behavior, Israel will be punished. But Iran is not looking for a fight. Iran is not looking for a war. Iran is looking for regional peace and prosperity that, you know, is engendered by stability, political stability, not the instability of conflict.
Right. Well, what about that, Shivan? You heard what Scott said, that Iran is not looking for a fight. But when we look at the reactions, whether we're talking about, well, you're in London, Rishi Sunak, and what he said, for example, after the Iran's retaliatory attacks, and saying that, again, the UK stands with Israel and condemned the Iranian attacks. And, of course, we saw the same thing coming from other various Western countries. Your thoughts on that, because this continual scenario that this Western hegemonic front has tried to show as Iran basically being the bad guy, the terrorist, and of course then the Israelis being the defenders of democracy. I mean, do you think that we're transitioning, that more and more people understand that lie now?
I think so. I think, you know, what has happened over the last 6 months has changed a lot of minds all across the world. Even people who were formerly, you know, very pro-Israel have turned against Israel given what has happened. There are, for example, some very strong conservative voices like, I think, Candace Owens and Tucker Carlson, who have actually been critical. And I think the narrative is changing. People like Rishi Sunak and that EU person, von der Leyen, or whatever they call her. I mean, you know, people are just tired of them. I actually don't even read their tweets or their stuff because it's the same thing that's recycled. And I think this is true for millions of people around the world, that they just see these Western leaders as hypocrites who talk about democracy, civil rights, civil liberties, human rights, but they don't actually exercise it. And I think these 6 months of Gaza has exposed that. So I don't know who listens to these people anymore except those who are deeply devoted to one particular narrative and will not change their minds. I mean, you see lots of Jews. I was home in New York in October, and there were lots of Jews. I'm a New Yorker, I'm living here, but I saw lots of Jews out there protesting, you know, what was going on in Gaza. And this is really one of the things that, you know, the media do not want to talk about, is that the Jewish view of Israel is not monolithic. And you can see that in the major Western cities and capitals as well. So I don't know who Rishi Sunak is trying to convince, except, you know, like what we call preaching to the choir, maybe.
Right. Well, looking at this Western hegemonic front, Scott, we saw that last night during Iran's retaliation attack, that France, UK, US, Jordan were all involved in actually trying to shoot down Iranian drones. Your take on that? I mean, what does that say about the Israeli regime itself? Does it mean that it does not have the capacity to take on Iran at all or alone? And what does that do for their own self-confidence in being that they could not do this alone?
Well, first of all, we need to understand that Israel has war-gamed out this scenario. And so they know the data. And they know what their saturation point is when it comes to their air defense ceasing to be effective against incoming targets. The other thing is the United States, France, Great Britain, they are part of this game of keeping Israel out of a broader war with Iran. And so it was in their interests to shoot down these targets. Iran wanted them to shoot down these targets. Iran sent overwhelming force that required the United States, Great Britain, France to put up their airplanes, to bring in their air defense, to come to the assistance of Israel, to mitigate the potential damage that could be done. And it was also a signal to all parties that, you know, Israel cannot stand alone. And therefore, it's in the interest of these parties to keep Israel out of a broader war, because in order to save Israel, they will have to be involved. But the same missiles that hit targets in Israel with precision accuracy can hit a British base in Cyprus. They can hit a French base. They can hit American installations in the Middle East. All of these nations now know that Iran has a capability that can hurt them in a time of conflict. And so this was a sort of this act of grand theater where Iran and the United States, they wrote a script, because the United States did not want, the United States knew that Iran had to strike. They understood the political reasoning behind it. They didn't want Iran to launch an overwhelming attack, and they let Iran know that. And Iran, not wanting a broader war, replied by sending enough force to send a message, but not too much, so that the United States could write a script that had its aircraft, its ships coming to the assistance of Israel, demonstrating friendship at the same time that Joe Biden picks up the phone, tells Benjamin Netanyahu that the United States will not participate in an attack against Israel. So we're friends under certain circumstances, but the friendship is not limitless. This is, again, part of the script that Iran was shaping. I think the Iranians deserve far more credit diplomatically as well, that this is not just a military victory. This is a diplomatic achievement of some note.
All right, and last question, Shivan. We only have like a minute of time, but there were videos being shown last night, Palestinians celebrating. Gazans are saying it was the first time that there was no buzzing of drones over their heads, and also Palestinians in the West Bank even approaching the, trying to tear down the apartheid wall. Let's talk in general about what could it mean. I mean, Iran has penetrated Israeli airspace, but if the Muslim countries were truly independent and united, what could that mean for the Palestinians?
Well, I think there was a great deal of cheering going on from Muslim countries. I saw comments from Pakistanis. I actually tweeted something from the Taliban where they were actually praying for a success.
Well, I'm mainly talking about the Muslim countries right on side of the Palestinian territories.
Oh, right. Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
Yeah, no problem.
Well, that's kind of difficult because, I mean, you know, their rulers are very much in terms on the side of the United States, and they will do what the United States wants them to do. So I'm not quite sure how much benefit there will be for the people, even though they will privately cheer, and I'm sure Jordanians and Lebanese and so, and Saudis and so on may have been cheering for Iran, but how that will benefit the Palestinian people is very difficult, because governments are not going to be supporting the Palestinian people.
And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me. Scott Ritter, former U.S. Marine Intelligence Officer out of New York, Shivan Mahendraraja, historian and author out of London. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight right here at Press TV. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Questions and answers and Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman, Allah, who is Al-Mannan. La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. Sheikh Rouhani is the guest speaker for today's discussion. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Inshallah, 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 you'll find your way.
Okay, Sheikh Rouhani, sometimes the Shiites are accused of polytheism, that they consider partner for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and somehow their look in the life is not a tawhidi or monotheistic one. How do you answer such accusations?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, I think this kind of accusations sometimes leveled by some of maybe the Salafis and Wahhabis against tashayyu. Why? Because tashayyu, the Shiite people believe, for example, in tawassul, in ziyara. This kind of belief that Shiite have, they might be considered as a kind of polytheistic sort of belief by some of these maybe Salafis and Wahhabis, or some of the Sunni maybe people. First of all, we should know that tashayyu is the most monotheistic kind of belief and sect and branches of Islam. This kind of accusations that leveled against us, it is false accusation. Because of what? Because look, tawheed means that you should believe in Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala as the only fa'il, or let's say performer of the creation or creator in the whole universe, and independently, and by his thought and his essence independently. But if in alam, in this universe, there are asbab and musabbabat, we believe that, for example, Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala set a kind of laws for nature, for this world, that okay, in this world, if there is fire, it should burn. If there is fire, there's burning. If you go inside, the fire will be burned. This is the nature. Here, God or Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala set this law that fire should burn. So now we cannot say that since we ask help from fire to cook, for example, our food or meal, it's a kind of shirk. Never. Because it has naturally its own impact, or let's say effect on the food.
Okay.
So, but this example, I want to tell you that in this world, in this universe, even those let's say Sunni brothers or Salafi and let's say Wahhabis, if they look at the history, if they go back to the history of Islam, they see, for example, before Islam, we have tawassul, which was performed by some of the prophets, salawatullahi alayhim ajma'in. For example, Prophet Yusuf sent his, let's say, shirt to his father, and the eyes of his father was cured and healed by the Yusuf's, let's say, qamis, which is mentioned in the Holy Quran. So here, asking cure or healness by Prophet Yaqub from the qamis of Yusuf, from the shirt or garment of Yusuf, is it something false? Is it something wrong? Is it kind of shirk that Yusuf committed, the Prophet of God, or Prophet Yaqub committed? Of course not. Never. Yaqub was muwahid, Yusuf was muwahid. But this tawassul to either people or not people, if sometimes it is performed by this belief that only Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the independent creator, but or the independent influencer, we can say, then the other things have this influence by the permission of Allah, by the help of Allah, by the, let's say, ruling of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala over all things. There's no problem with that. And also in the history of Islam, we have that the second caliph, Umar ibn Khattab, in the traditional sources of Sunni brothers, it is mentioned that he himself says that, O Allah, we were trying to attain proximity to you by the Prophet after the demise of your Prophet by Abbas, the uncle of the Prophet. It is mentioned in their sources. Well, when we look at, for example, they say that why do you ask from the dead bodies of the people something?
Yes.
So if the dead body is really dead body and has nothing